Did you know a 2018 study showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual. When I was 4 months pregnant, I couldn't find a prenatal I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested for heavy metals, and recently earned the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. But don't just take my word for it. Get 25% off at ritual.com/prenatal.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, like Aloe or Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret? With Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going. So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell whatever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/try to upgrade your selling today. Shopify.com/try.
Welcome to the Gravity Podcast, where we host conversations on developing a Christian spirituality rooted in love that fosters resilient faith in everyday life.
Okay, Ben, I've told you several times I am not interested in Bitcoin. Welcome to the Gravity Commons Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Tebbe. Christy's here. As well as Ben Sternke. Hello.
Hey, y'all. Good to be
together. I need another cup
together.
Of coffee.
Yeah. You dragging today?
Yeah. I don't know what my deal is.
What's your deal?
What's my deal?
I heard, Chrissy, I don't want to presume how old you are because I can't remember. And some people are sensitive about these things.
I look 21.
I read an article... or at least like a summary of an article that said that as scientists are looking at aging now.
Wait a minute, Ben. Are you gonna mention menopause?
No,
don't do that. Don't.
I'm not going to.
Don't.
Although that is something that is discussed frequently in my home because they're discovering a lot of things about that too. But I'm not going to talk about that.
All right.
So their scientists are discovering that aging. Like the stuff that happens in your body as you age, like molecules being replaced and, you know, things like that, it doesn't really happen in a gradual line, but it seems to have concentrated around two different ages where a lot of changes take place.
Oh.
And one of the ages is 44 and the other one is 60, where like a lot of aging stuff happens at 44 and a lot of aging stuff happens at 60. And I was like, that is... fascinating. So it's not like a gradual decline, but there's like a lot of things happen at 44 and 60. And I was like, that is fascinating.
I am a late bloomer, so maybe it's all happening even though I'm not 44.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, or an early bloomer, I guess, if you're not 44
or
yet.
Or very early. Very early.
I mean, you're only 21, right? Is that what you said?
Right. You know.
Yeah. So very early bloomer for aging. Anyway.
I take lots of supplements to counter aging.
Me too.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Don't you guys... Anyway, we don't need to get into it.
Ben?
You should take some vitamins, Ben.
I don't know. I feel like all that stuff is like snake oil salesman.
No, everybody is low in vitamin D. Like pretty much everybody. You are not outside enough. You got to take vitamin D for sure.
True?
I mean, I don't know.
And I like to reply to the snake oil allegations quickly. The guy I bought the supplements from, very clearly on his van, in large letters, it said, not snake oil.
Not snake oil. Oh, okay. Well, that proves it. Yeah. Right? Oh, wait. Did you read it on the internet that it works? Because that also would prove,
he told me
its effectiveness.
When he beckoned me to drive around to the back side of the Walmart, and
that's how you knew this guy was legit.
Opened up his van doors to show me his wares. He whispered into my ear,
"Yeah,
it all works.
It all works." Do you have a trench coat? I feel like the trench coat would be the coup d'etat.
You know that's what? When there used to be infomercials on television, like back when people didn't just stream on demand things, there used to be like infomercials, you know, like the ShamWow and these crazy inventions,
QVC
the Dean King,
is like a big deal. Yeah.
But I've got a person in my life who doesn't spend money at all, like super frugal, like it's almost an unhealthy obsession about not spending money or saving money, except for like elixirs and inversion tables and prostate Ouija boards. Like there's all kinds of he loves the thing on the infomercial that if you call now they throw in two more free.
I feel like all of us, one of my theories about human beings in America, at least, is that I feel like all of us have one of those like susceptibilities where all of us are like fairly rational and sort of critical thinkers, except for one area of our life where we just will willy-nilly believe people and spend money on stuff. I feel like everybody has one area of their life where they're like, that seems fine, right? They're just totally gullible.
Yeah. I don't know. Where would that be for you, Ben?
I don't know if I would know what it is. Because I think all of us probably walk around just assuming that we're making rational decisions until somebody else says, like, what are you doing? What's going on here? So I don't know what it might be for me. I think.
Just ask your wife. I bet she knows.
She probably does. Gosh.
Maybe that's some homework for our next time.
There you go.
Where am I susceptible to be completely gullible?
Right. Just I'll watch one, video on the internet and think, that's great. I'm going to buy that, mosquito trap for $80. It's going to work.
I know.
The bark box. That's what I would be gullible for.
Oh, the dog. What's that? The little dog subscription thing?
No. It's like a little box. Okay. If my neighbors are listening, I'm really sorry, but I bought this box and it's called the bark box. And you like put it and you angle it towards your neighbor's house and it like puts off like a high pitched noise so that their dog doesn't bark anymore.
Oh my gosh.
And I didn't ask if I could do it. I just put it up, and you guys, you know what? It works. My neighbor's dog is not barking near as much.
Oh, that's wonderful.
I'm a believer.
But and nobody can hear it. It's just the dog.
Right.
The dog. You're just torturing the dog. I mean, other than that, everything's fine.
Our listeners are going to write in and be like, you should have gotten permission. I know I should have, and I didn't. So please don't turn me into the cops. I am taking my neighbor out for breakfast and like,
to make 10
minutes. So,
in 10 minutes. Okay. To talk about the bark box?
I can tell him. I bought a bark box.
Yeah.
Bark box.
Well,
it's funny.
I think we know what Ben's is.
What is mine?
I mentioned it earlier, Bitcoin.
I'm eager to know.
And I'm really not interested. I think it's over. I think it's done. It's
cryptocurrency.
Passed. That whole thing.
I think that could be one for a lot of people.
Yeah.
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 That's not for me, though. For
I think supplements are the thing for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would agree.
Yeah.
You're fairly eager.
Nope, not even eager and not gullible. Mm-hmm. I prefer to think of myself as an early adapter.
Yes. Okay. Eventually the whole world is going to be taking this stuff. We're all going to discover that this helps with our bone density or something.
Yeah. There are no wrong supplements.
Yeah,
there's just maybe different. I'm the wrong species for the supplement.
This substance is good for something.
No, I think when I was a kid, I was super gullible about alien abduction stories.
Oh, yeah. Oh.
Remember those were a big deal in the 80s, 70s and 80s? I'm not sure what that was about, but because you never hear of that happening at all anymore, right? No one ever gets.
Although there was that whole kerfuffle recently though about UFOs where they were like they're real.
Well, they
did like a whole subset of the internet that was like, "Yep, it's real." See,
well, the government released basically said, "Yeah, they're real." Did you know that? The government basically came out and said these things are we can't explain them, and here's a bunch of documented cases about them.
Yeah,
I have a friend who is like very smart and tells stories to me and kind of freaks me out sometimes. Because of how much he believes it.
Yeah.
Christy.
I'm telling you, he watched ET.
You can tell me to stop doing that, and I will. I think it's because I watched ET when I was like 5.
Yeah.
Close Encounters of the Third Kind when I was like 6 or 7.
Yeah.
Right? There were these huge, Star Wars was huge when I was a kid. So I was like, oh, the space shuttle went up for the first time when I was a kid. So all these huge things happened with outer space, and I was, Star Trek? I was all in it. I was all about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think there's some scientific plausibility about some of that stuff. Like I read this sci-fi series called The Three Body Problem.
Oh, and,
that is actually a really fascinating, you know, that he explores a lot of interesting sort of science fiction concepts. And one of them is like, you know, the probability that we're like the only sentient, you know, species in the universe is just really, really low. But then like, they're like, well, why don't we know about anything? And there's all kinds of theories about it that he explores in the book through narrative. It's fascinating. So it's really fascinating.
Wow. All right. Anyway, well,
I almost got into it, but I was like, this is not going to be interesting for, you know, most of our listeners.
We need to get into an interview with Christy.
There's no segue for Christy.
Yeah, there's no great segue into this. Sorry, Christy. We had a great interview with Christy Adams.
Here, we did.
I'll do it.
Okay.
Ready?
You know who else had a childhood?
Christy Adams?
Yes. And she joins us today.
Incredible.
Christy Lauren Adams is a speaker, writer, youth advocate, and ordained Baptist minister. She is the award-winning author of Parable of the Brown Girl, as well as Unbossed, How Black Girls Are Leading the Way. She formerly worked as Dean of Spiritual Life and Equity at the Hill School in Pottstown, Pennsylvania, and now is the Executive Director of Community and Belonging at the St. Paul's Schools in Maryland. She joins us today to talk about her latest book, Womenish Theology, Discovering God Through the Lens of Black Girlhood. Christy Adams, welcome to the Gravity Commons podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Maybe by way of introduction, Christy, we heard your bio in the intro, but maybe give us an idea of how Christianity or Christ became important to you. Tell us a little bit about your spiritual journey.
Yeah, I believe that a lot of who I am spiritually was passed down to me from my family. Sometimes the reason why I say that and I lead with that is because when I was younger, I had a tendency to disregard that. And, you know, for me, after high school and when I really started to take ownership over my own faith in college, I was very much a proponent of, you know, when did you become, you know, on your own, apart from your family, as though that wasn't like legitimate because they passed it on to me. So therefore, you know, it was something I was told to do. But I think as I've gotten older, I've had more of an appreciation for the fact that it was passed along to me. It very much is in the DNA. Spirituality and Christianity is very much in the DNA of my family, my roots, my grandmother, my great grandmother, you know. And if not for them, I wouldn't be who I am today. So I'm grateful to have had that upbringing. My parents were leaders in the church. So I grew up in the Baptist church. My dad was a deacon for 30 years. You know, he served on the benevolence committee, which, you know, extended sort of like money and resources to people who were in need in the community and in the church. And I got to watch that growing up. My mom was also a deacon as well, but she also was an educator, and a lot of her ministry extended to her, you know, her outreach to her students who were of so many different socioeconomic backgrounds. My pastor was not just our pastor, but he was the Secretary of State of New Jersey and for a few years. And, you know, I'm not bringing that up for like a political necessarily means as much as like, you know, just to show that there was very much an extension of our church into society, into the community. So I never saw my faith as being you know, apart from my neighbors, like ever. And so that I will say, was what I was introduced to from when I was a little girl all the way to graduating from high school. And that's basically where I get my philosophy from and my theology from today.
Yeah. Well, that's encouraging, Christy. Maybe that dovetails into, I wanted to ask you about the title of your book, right? The title is Womanish Theology, Discovering God Through the Lens of Black Girlhood. And I think most of our listeners are familiar with things like feminist theology. We've talked about womanist theology in the past. But I think maybe for some of our listeners, the word womanish will be new. So help us out. Like, what is womanish theology? And did you come up with that? Or is that an established or well-known sort of genre of theology?
So the term, very, very similar to womanist and womanism, in and of itself, I didn't create, right? But then there's like womanism, and then there's womanist theology, which like Katie Cannon, right, was known as being one of the founders of the actual theology, but not necessarily the term womanist, right? So I would say the same thing for womanish. The term womanish comes from author Alice Walker. She coins it in her book In Search of Our Mother's Gardens. And it's a term that she didn't even come up with. It's a term that was sort of passed down through generations. You know, grandmothers or elders in the Black community, you know, would say to the little girls, like, you acting womanish, you know, stop acting womanish, but basically meaning like stop acting grown or too mature for, et cetera. It is sort of known as, I don't want to say a negative term, but when you're saying stop acting womanish, it's something that you don't necessarily want to be. You want to, like, if you're a child, stay in a child's place, right? Mm-hmm. But, or like if I put on, you know, lipstick when I was younger, put on my mother's heels or something like that, there's this idea that you're acting womanish, right? So it's like a playful, but not necessarily like totally negative term. But it's a girlish term, like you're girlish, and you're acting too grown. And so, the term has been used multiple times. I'm not the first person. And so, womanish is where womanist comes from, actually. So where womanism comes from that term womanish.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. But when I was thinking about titling this book, I was thinking back, I was looking at the definition and I was like, man, maybe it's more womanish because I'm not separating completely from womanism, right? Because we are talking about Black girls' experiences who grow up to be Black women. And womanism, it sort of presupposes, you know, girlhood too. It's involved in womanism. It doesn't completely, you know, ignore girlhood experiences. However, I believe that womanism focuses a lot on adult experiences, and that girls, particularly Black girls, deserve their own category. It's just like girlhood studies is apart from, you know, feminist studies, right? And so when I was thinking through that, obviously I tagged on theology to it because I really was focusing a lot in the book on the early spiritual experiences and the faith and spiritual development of Black girls and when that begins. And so I tagged theology on it because I was thinking through, oh, when was the first time I was introduced to salvation? When was the first time I was introduced to this? And these are things I didn't think about in seminary. I went to Princeton, as you know, and when I was there, I thought this was like brand new. Like, this is the first time I'm learning about systematic theology, and perhaps in the terms of, like, you know, the sort of traditional terms, like the classical terminology. But it really wasn't the first time. But I didn't know that until I left. When I was there, it was like, I'm new. Let me just take all this in. But as the years have gone on, it was like, well, I learned about prayer from my grandmother. She taught me the Lord's Prayer, you know? And I learned about salvation really, really early, particularly as a Baptist, right? When communion was going by, and I'm sitting next to my grandmother in church and they're passing the plate and they overlook me. And I'm like, wait a minute. And she's like, no, you can't take that until you're baptized. You know, and it's like, well, why not? Well, I want to get baptized. And so even though these concepts weren't necessarily fleshed out until maybe a little bit later for me, I was introduced to them pretty early. And so anyway, so that's where womanist theology comes from. I'm not sure there's other womanist theologies out there. So I just tried to coin the term.
We'll be right back.
People are driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. The hiring process can be slow and overwhelming. Simplify hiring with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. Listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. That's Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Terms and conditions apply.
Let's get back to the show. Ben, I'm struck by how Chrissy's narrating her journey, and it's very similar to what you've told me about your journey and mine, and that is like actually having to wake up that theology proper maybe should be more accurately called white theology and white male theology, right? And it's, Chrissy, sounds like when you go to Princeton, you're like, oh, okay, now I'm going to learn theology.
Right, right, right.
And then in learning theology, you kind of wake up to the fact of, no, this is one perspective of theology. Mm-hmm. And I actually have baked in my body and my bones another perspective that has value and integrity and goodness in it. I wonder, before we jump into the book, I wonder, like, how do you navigate that? Like, we're coming from sort of like a world in which there's just one supremacist frame or lens, and we use that to sort of silence or marginalize other voices, right? And now we're learning how to listen or reclaim our own voice or other voices to help give deeper or greater or more perspectival knowledge about things. How do you navigate integrating like womanish theology of your upbringing, you know, with John Calvin?
Yeah. You know? it's so hard, you know, even when you fight to center yourself in your stories, when you've been sort of told your whole life that you're just an elective, because even at Princeton, feminist womanist was an elective, you know, no shade to them. It just was. Really, honestly, there's a professor named Mark Taylor at Princeton. And when we took systematic theology, you know, everyone had to take it. And he had James Cone on the syllabus, and there was an uproar, right? Like, you know, and he had other Mujerista theologies, you know, like liberation theologies. He had that on his syllabus, along with Paul Tillich, along with Karl Barth. And people were upset because that's not systematic theology. I'm not taking that elective, you know, I'm taking this. But the reason why I say it's still a fight, like an internal fight, I will say that, to it's so normalized that even after writing this book, you know, like it's a constant every day, and it's an unlearning too. There was a young Black girl, I spoke at a middle school in February, and after I was doing a book signing, and a girl was in middle school, of course, she stopped me and she said, "Can I talk to you after you're done?" I was like, "Sure," you know, and she waited for a while, and then I was like, "Oh my God, I completely forgotten." And she said, "Did you ever not like your skin and your hair when you were my age?" And I was like, "Yeah." I said, "You know, why? Do you not like yourself?" And she was like, "Yeah, I don't." And it was just like, wow, you know. But she asked me what advice I had for her. And I was just like, I felt so sad, you know, because there's so much to unlearn for her, even as a middle schooler, that I couldn't even just give advice in that moment. And what I was trying to share with her is that it's going to be an ongoing thing your whole life, because you're living in a society where one particular voice is centered, but then also where who you are, your existence is a marginalized identity, and you have to constantly put yourself there. So it's ongoing. There's no end to it. It's a constant reminding, a constant self-assurity, because it's these voices and these theologians that are important, though, still have just been at the forefront for so long that you're the lone voice trying to center yourself and these little girls' voices. It's difficult.
Yeah. Well, maybe on that theme, I know, you know, this, yours is your own past was not the only Black girl voice, you know, that you, listened to, as you researched and wrote this book. And you're sort of like, you know, outlining for us kind of how Black girls do all things Christian and theology. And there's lots of different topics that are covered, you know, throughout the book. And so I'm curious which, as you sort of researched and listened to other Black women and Black girls, I'm curious if there's a particular chapter or maybe a part of a chapter where that listening sort of held a lot of salience for you, or like where you made a significant discovery in writing the book. I don't know if there's anything that you want to highlight.
So I have a chapter called Womanish Theodicy that basically talks about, you know, the term theodicy is this idea of if God is a good God, then why would that God allow evil and suffering to happen? And I start off with my own, you know, story of when my friend was killed when I was 15. And all the questioning and the doubting that ensued. The girls that I interviewed, you know, they varied as far as what their personal experiences were. Some may have had their, you know, own personal illness. Some may have lost their mother or a family member. One lost to an overdose. And then others just, you know, regular Black girls, you know, every day. I think I expected them to have a little bit more of a pessimistic view. Like, I think I expected them to blame God on things. Like, when I asked those tough questions, and I, like, didn't get that, you know? And, like, I feel like my generation, you know, growing up sort of the 90s kid, the personal relationship with Jesus generation, I call that, I feel like we just automatically, like, if something didn't go my way, I'm mad at God. Right. Because you're supposed to be my personal savior, you know, supposed to be, you know, helping me on my exam, you know, whereas this generation sees, and I wouldn't just say Black girls, just from my just working with young people, I think because they are the active school shooter generation, I think because they're a little bit more in tune with what's happening in society, they have a bit more of a communal understanding of the divine. Right.
Interesting.
And I think because of that, they see like they have a part too. Like it's almost like God doesn't owe us anything. That we're just sort of grateful to be here. And, you know, I do, they do question, but it feels like a healthy questioning. I think I was expecting like anger when I asked those types of questions, like, why do you think God would allow this to happen? You know, I was almost like, you know, egging them on, just trying to pull that out. And they were like, you know, I don't know, but you know, in the end, you know, I just focused on the positive. I just, you know, like, I'm just grateful. They have that gratitude was not a part of my language growing up as a 90s Christian kid. I don't know why. It was praise. And Thanksgiving. But gratitude, I see that these young people is like very much a part of their lifestyle and their mindset and perspective. So, you know, things the girls that I would interview about things that were happening in their lives would say, I have questions. But at the end of the day, you know, I'm grateful for X, Y, and Z, and I'm grateful for my family. So it's a that resilience. It shouldn't have shocked me, but it was a real blessing to me.
Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah, there's an element of like listening to voices of young women, teenage girls, girls that feels transgressive, right? Like, you know, you went to Princeton, I went to seminary. There's sort of in the Western kind of European consciousness, there is this hierarchy of knowledge where, you know, doctors mm-hmm. teach, right? Mm-hmm. So this project is a bit transgressive because you're not only reclaiming your own girlhood voice in the text, mm-hmm. but you also have these block quotes from girls in the text. And I wonder if you could just speak a bit about learning from kids. I mean, I know you spend your vocation is working with kids. Can you talk about how learning from kids is transgressive, but why it's vital?
I mean, I don't want to get the scripture wrong. You guys know the scripture where, I mean, because it has to be the foundational scripture, right? Here it is. It's at the end. I use the same scripture in my first book, Parable of the Brown Girl. So I said, listening to the theological perspectives of Black girls can point us to God. In Parable of the Brown Girl, I write, in Matthew 18, Jesus calls a little child over to him and the disciples, saying, truly I tell you, unless you change and become like little children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. That is literally my entire like educational philosophy when it comes to working with young people. I mean, we got to stop there. I don't know what we think that scripture is about or what we've sort of like pacified it, you know, to be, but they have to become our teachers and we have to be students. And that takes a certain level of humility in order to do that. And so whether I'm working with the students at the schools that I work at, or whether it's with this specific demographic of young Black girls, anytime I interview, any conversation, you know, even when I'm teaching, I taught a class called Religion and Film in Contemporary Society for 6 years when I was at the Hill School. And that was like my favorite part of the job because I'd go in every day and I would like learn so much from them. I'd have a whole lesson, but I would be learning from them too. It was an environment of just learning as opposed to going in as you're the teacher and they're just listening and then you're moving on. Like so much could take place if that, you know, if you go in with that mindset and if you set that atmosphere that this is like this is a reciprocal relationship that is taking place. And reciprocity isn't usually how adults view children.
Right.
So.
Yeah.
Christy, I want to jump in here and just ask a question. You shared throughout your book how your experiences growing up in the Black church has shaped your faith and your spirituality. Can you just share with us what gifts did your Black church upbringing give you?
Man. all the theologies that I listed in the book in every chapter.
Yeah.
I mean, a womanish theology of service. A womanish theology of justice, which isn't in there. That was a chapter that was going to get in there, but you know, mainly service and justice and a love for my neighbor, is what I got from, I mean, everything was fellowship. Everything was community. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know. I think back sometimes and I think, what if I had grown up in just a Sunday morning church? You know, where you just attend and you listen to the pastor and you go home. Like, who would I be? That was just a small part. And sometimes I see with churches is that is the main event. That is the main attraction, right? Our service on Sunday morning. And it was to an extent, don't get me wrong, you know. That was just one of many. I never saw, like when I thought of church, I literally never thought of Sunday morning. Like I thought the whole week.
I thought
vacation Bible school. We had a summer, we called it the Summer Youth Institute, which is our summer camp. And I've started off going there and then I was a youth counselor. So we had that. We had a community development corporation that had employment readiness program. We had a youth center in the bottom, in the basement, called the Underground Youth Enrichment Center. We had in the top floor, Harvest of Hope Foster Care Agency. I mean, like, I just saw us as being the arms and legs of Jesus in the community. Yeah. And so when I grew up, I never saw anything different.
Yeah.
like, you know? And so when I got to college, it wasn't, the first thing I thought was not, what church can I join and become a member of? It was, how can I serve the community? Mm. That's literally how I saw my responsibility and where I saw Jesus the most. Like, greatest gift that they could have given me.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, I'm struck, you know, Christy, we were talking earlier about, you know, how womanish theology or black theology sort of feels like this elective, you know, under something called theology that we're actually, you know, learning to relativize, right, and say, well, that's actually white theology. But anyway, I'm just struck by, you know, like how many sort of things that feel like they were on the cutting edge of white theology a few years ago, like in the missional church, the emerging church movement. There was a lot of effort being given to sort of try to reconnect our belonging in the body of Christ with community service, mm-hmm. you know, with working for justice, mm-hmm. you know, all of these things that are sort of like really, they feel really new mm-hmm. in sort of the white theology world. I'm just struck in your description of what it's like to grow up, you know, in the black church. I'm just struck by how it's like, oh, well, black people have been doing this for a long time. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? They've been just doing this, like it's just been integrated for people in the black church for a long time. And anyway, I'm just struck by how, I don't know how I feel a little bit naive, and silly, you know, honestly, like with just how sort of enraptured we all were with these new discoveries. And it's like, oh, never mind. And we never thought to learn from the black church. So anyway, yeah. It's more of a, there's no question in that. I'm just struck by that.
Because
yeah, please do.
I think a lot of it was survival. Right.
Oh, yeah.
As opposed to just practice. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, outside for so long, outside of our community decades ago, generations ago, this was all we had.
Right.
And so this was the black church was the place where the individual had a voice. And the black church was a place where, because society was so oppressive and antagonistic against us, this is where we raised funds for each other, right? Mm-hmm. With no mm-hmm. social services, we were social services, right? Like, yeah. There was sort of, it took a village. So it was a foundational and a necessary institution to the identity, the confidence, right? Yeah. To sort of the uplifting, like, we're creating opportunities for ourselves because there are no opportunities outside of this space. And even like a democratic type of, you know, system where there's like, you know, the congregation has a voice and we have leadership. There was no leadership for black mm-hmm. people, right? Not mm-hmm. in society, you know, outside of this. So we created leadership, you know, within that. And so it was like the black church, I believe, you know, was created, yes, to worship God, but for an upliftment of people and community empowerment and to support. So because of that, when they were created in these communities, the black people that lived in the communities, they didn't have anywhere to go outside right. of that space right. for help, yeah. for support. And that's why when I mentioned my dad doing benevolence, right? And we would take up every Sunday, we have a regular offering and tithe. And I'm sure there's other churches that have benevolence. It's not like just the black church, but we would have a benevolence you know, thing that you can check off. I'm giving $15 toward benevolence. And there was a benevolence fund of however many thousands of dollars. Yeah. And the people in the community, again, because this has been happening for decades, right? Years and years, would come to, even if they didn't attend First Baptist, and say, my light bill is off. Or I didn't pay my mortgage and they're getting ready to evict me. Can you help? Or I got to bury my aunt, you know, like, yeah. and we don't have the resources. We don't have a place to go and bury them because we don't have the money to do it in a funeral home or whatever. Like it was just, that had been something that we did that mm-hmm. had been going on for years. But again, I think previously it was out of necessity and survival as opposed to just like general spiritual practice.
Yeah. Yeah. It wasn't an optional sort of interesting, you know, academic, pursuit. There was no choice about the matter. It was just how things were. I think there's something in that. Yeah. I appreciate you sharing that. Thank you, Christy.
Yeah.
And now a word from a sponsor.
Hey, the Gravity Commons podcast is supported by Respero. Henry Nouwen once wrote, "The role of a counselor is to help people not suffer for the wrong reasons," which I really like. This is one of the guiding principles of Respero's counselor training. They equip you to listen deeply, ask great questions, and speak words of life into the hearts and minds of hurting people. Their training cohorts, which a lot of our listeners have actually gone through and have said that they really enjoy. Their training cohorts feature lots of personal interaction and practice with feedback, and it's all rooted in the belief that Jesus is the source of life. So check it out at respero.org and learn how to move people toward real transformation, not just symptom removal.
And if I may, Ben, for pastors and ministry leaders, Respero's training is kind of a proven way to identify people in your church who have a gift for counseling and helping others. And it can be a powerful way to help make your church a genuine healing community. So they provide training and supervision that will allow your people to do great work and free up the pastoral staff, right? So, you know, I think we as pastors, we understand our job is to equip the saints for the work of ministry. And I think Respero then kind of digs a little deeper and actually gives those saints sort of the hard and soft skills of how to do the work, right? Yeah. So go to Respero, RESPERO.org, and click on the counselor training tab. Listener, this ad is different than other ads. Ben and I are going to be at a conference, and we want you to join us. We did a national gathering for Gravity in 2017. We did a grief kind of retreat last summer, and we've been looking for ways to gather this year with all y'all because we love spending time with you, and we got invited into something called Theology Beer Camp, which is October 17th through 19th in Denver, Colorado. We're joining a host of other people from around the country. We're going to do some podcasting there. Ben, who all is going to be there?
I'm excited about Ilya Delio.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
The unbearable wholeness of being changed my life.
Yeah, incredible. Brian McLaren's going to be there. Diana Butler-Bass, Brian Zond.
We know him.
Other folks.
Yeah, there's going to be lots of podcasting, lots of keynote speaking, and lots of time to hang out. There's going to be a lot of relational time, and we may even record some podcasts. We'd love to record podcasts even with you, listener. They've given us a discount code for all of our listeners because we are a sponsor. Yeah. So if you go to gravitycommons.com/theologycamp and use the code GravityHobbit, that'll give you an idea of the kind of gathering we're doing here. You get $25 off tickets. Prices go up soon, so register today.
Yep. Beer is optional, by the way.
Yeah, but theology isn't.
Theology isn't, but the beer is optional. All right, that code again, or the website again, friends, is gravitycommons.com/theologycamp. And make sure to use our code GravityHobbit, two Bs, to get $25 off tickets. Hope to see you there. All right, let's get back into our conversation.
As you mentioned, Christy, you've already mentioned like theodicy or suffering and evil. You've mentioned service, but each chapter looks at a different aspect of Christian theology or spirituality, including, you know, being created in the image of God, salvation, hospitality. I wonder, your first chapter, I wonder if we could just give a flavor of the work you're doing here, because you talk about womanish theology of Scripture and how girls, Black girls, interpret Scripture. I know for a lot of our listeners, they're stuck with unhelpful exegetical or hermeneutical commitments that they were sort of raised in. And they want to find a way to read the Scriptures that, for instance, make sense or don't scandalize their conscience or don't trigger them even. So I wonder what, maybe just as a by way of giving us a flavor of the work you're doing, what can we learn from Black girls about reading the Scriptures?
Yeah, there's this, again, I'm trying to look through her part because I'm thinking of something in particular. A few things. These contemporary Black girls, because also in the book, what I do is I interview Black women, adults who could look back onto their girlhoods, and what their perspective of, or the first times they were introduced to prayer or scripture. But I'll respond in terms of like the sort of modern day Black girls. You know, it's very similar to the Theodicy, where I, you know, it's like they have such a healthy way of critiquing, but not throwing out. And for me growing up, it was all or nothing. You know, it was like you're either saved or you're falling away. Right. And I wasn't really introduced. It wasn't really until seminary that I got introduced to, I think I call it a hermeneutic of suspicion, right? Where you're sort of giving yourself permission to analyze and critique and question and doubt. And you do it in a healthy way. I always saw it as being just negative and you don't believe in God, you know, or that's heretic. You're heretical. They don't use language like that. They don't know language like that. But they, you know, they see scripture, but because they know how to approach it with a healthy sense of critique, like I said, they don't just say it doesn't have anything to do with me, get rid of it. You know, they're able to find what works for them and to sort of put aside what doesn't. And you know, I don't know if adults will love that, but for me, I'm like, I'm just glad that they're, you know, they're reading. I'm glad that they're open. And so, like I said, in the book, you know, there are some parts where there's one girl in one of the quotes, she's talking about evil and why does evil happen? Why did Adam and Eve happen? And she doesn't understand that. She said, I have always had a lot of questions, but I never doubted my faith. I mean, their faith is still very personal to them. Their spiritual journeys are still very personal. And so the Bible, their spirituality and their faith does not rise and fall on what they read in the Bible that they may or may not like. Whereas again, that wasn't what I was taught necessarily growing up. It was like, you reject any part of the Bible, then you need to question where you're at spiritually as well. They don't see the two as one and the same. Again, don't know if that's a good, you know what I mean? Don't know if people will love that, you know, but I think it's healthy for when you're younger or when you're newer in the faith to have that perspective until you can get to a place, you know, where you can evolve and move on.
Yeah, totally.
Christy, I'm struck by, like, you know, I grew up in the white church and in learning white theology. I thought it was just theology, right? But now there's feminist and womenist and womenish. And how do you listen to diverse perspectives and make voices, making room for many without getting lost and overwhelmed? I guess as we move towards letting voices speak and not silencing anyone, how do you honor those voices while holding on to who you are and where you came from?
I think it's similar to the question about children. You have to have a foundation and a starting point. Like when it comes to diving into any work like this or diving into anything new or nuanced, you have to have a firm foundation. That sounds really like Christianese, but you really do have to have a firm foundation. Because if you don't, and the reason why I say that is because my firm foundation for that type of question is the Imago Dei, right? Is the image of God. And is this idea that if we were all created in the image of God and we all have different fingerprints, like that's crazy. That's still crazy to me. I learned that when I was a kid. We all have different fingerprints. We all look completely different. We're all so completely different from the inside out. Mm-hmm. Yet we're all made in the image of God. And so if that's the case, there's so much to learn about God. And the one way to learn about God is from each other, because we're all made in the image of God. If that is my foundation and my philosophy, right, that I believe in the Imago Dei and that we were all created in the image of God. And so I see the world as, oh my God, I have so much to learn. Like, I will never stop learning from, you know, the three of you on this call, or, you know, when I'm in a classroom full of kids, because that's a lot of people to cover as far as like getting to know different aspects of who God is. But it doesn't take away from me either, right? Because I'm also the image of God and my experiences are also valid. So the idea that there's room at the table, which is again, like kind of Christianese, but like if there's room at the table for all of us, and that me learning or opening myself up to a child or to a person of another ethnicity or background, it doesn't take away from, but it adds to. Yeah. And so we have to let go of that fear, right? Which is what I see with a lot of people in society. There's such a fear that if you do open up, even if you expose yourself to other faiths, that I'm no longer Christian, I'm going to lose my Christianity or my faith. And that's not the case, right? Because I'm just opening up to learning. It doesn't mean I'm taking on anything. So it's like, okay, white theology, right? We just said, well, I'm not becoming Paul Tillich, right? Like, I'm not morphing into Karl Barth, right? Mm-hmm. Like, but I might be able to take some things, or I might have, like, you know, a leaning toward a particular favorite theologian in some of the ways that they think it aligns with me and my values and what I've learned. But I don't morph into them. So why are we hesitant to learn from anyone else thinking that we're going to become a convert or whatever it might be? So again, it has to come back to the how firm your foundation is and your beliefs. And my belief is in the Imago Dei. My belief is we were all created in the image of God. And therefore we have a lot to learn.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I'm struck by, I'm doing sermon prep, maybe by way to close, Christy, I'm doing sermon prep for this weekend. And I was reading Exodus 16 about, the Israelites in the wilderness, and they were making complaints about not having any food and how they actually missed the meat of slavery versus, you know, the fasting of freedom or whatever. And in twice in this text, Moses and the Lord both say, the Lord has heard your complaint. And I think that like freedom, audacity, you know, I know another book, you have the unbossed kind of, there's a sass there. There's a talking back to God that I feel like, I picked up in the womanish, like in How to Pray and other places too, that there's not a cowering before like doing something wrong, but there's this freedom to wrestle, to complain, to show up, to pop off, to speak your mind. And then to know that it's not going to ruin the relationship, that God can handle that. And I think as I read, like, I feel like I want to give that to the people I grew up with. I want to give that to the people in my church, because there's a openness and a freedom there that I feel like many of us don't have. So anyway, I think that's more of me just like saying, thank you. Right. Thank you.
I'm smiling because I was just talking to my boyfriend, and you know, we had a little back and forth last night. And so this morning he was like, we were on the phone, and he said, "You're not excited. You must not be excited about me today," or something like that. And I was like, "You know, we can have back and forths and tips, and like, I'm still excited. You know what I mean? And we're still in this." And I think if we like, because, you know, and I say that because like some Christians have a tendency to like, we use relationship examples all the time. That's like the one thing that we can like understand God through. This is my first time ever doing that. But that's because it just happened this morning, because I'm just thinking like it's, you know, there's no throwing away God, and God's not throwing us away when we have these moments. Yeah. It's we can have these moments. That is what relationship is. And God is just as excited about us, right? And we are just as loved. And my relationship is nowhere near what it would be with myself and God, right? Because God is like God. But I think the same thing with these girls too. You know, it's something that's just automatic. They haven't been, for the most part, not to say that all haven't, but they haven't received the messages that God is going to be mad at you in the way that I receive messages in sort of evangelicalism growing up in, you know, late 90s, right? Or that, you know, they see God apart from how we do things, mm-hmm. you know? So we might throw people away or we might get on, but they're like, God is, it's not associated with God. And I just, oh man, what would that have been like to grow up that way and not have to unlearn that? Cause I still go through that quite a bit. God is mad. God is disappointed. Yeah. You know, all of that. I don't hear that language from them, but again, that messaging they never got. They are putting it all on society. This is society's doing, right? Like poverty is society's fault, right? Like these shootings that are happening, we're going to get out there and we're going to march for our rights. We're not going and talking about God where, you know, like God's going to be on our side when we go out and march for our rights, you know? Mm. They just have such a healthy relationship with God that, you know, it's taken me so long to get to.
That's another thing I noticed too, is that, you know, the Black church isn't exclusively Baptist, but largely a lot of Baptist tradition, and how that integration of sort of the real world and the spiritual world, sort of the overlap or the thinness of the space there, is very sacramental, right? Ironically, because there's just an awareness that God is with us, and that we can pray on Sunday morning at 11:30 in the morning, and we can pray at the, you know, and we'll be praying as we march, right? Or as we register voters. And it's just, there seems to be a different spirit and a different energy there that innervates that than there is with, you know, more of the strident, divisive culture war kind of models or postures of Christianity and politics that we see in other spaces. Right?
Yeah. Well, I think it all comes down to the struggle, right? Like the, we had collective struggle for so long, right? Sort of like the civil rights movement, the quintessential scene in the movie Selma when, you know, Martin Luther King kneels down, everybody kneels behind him. It's like there was a collective struggle, racism and slavery. And so I think when that happens, then you get results sort of like that. There's a humility. There is a real leaning on God because we absolutely need, you know, or this vote isn't just about, oh, my vote, my rights. You know, it's literally like life or death. Life or death was such a main part of the Black church forever, right? Like that we're just now somewhat, I mean, I don't even want to say I'm the tail end of it, but I mean, when you think about it, even if you start with the civil rights movement and go back, it was always life or death.
Yeah.
You know, as a church.
Yeah, that matters. Got to see power to love like God does and to be faithful today. The book again, Womanish Theology, Discovering God Through the Lens of Black Girlhood. Christy, thanks so much for being with us today.
You know, I was struck in that interview. My parents are divorced, and growing up, whenever I would visit my dad on the weekends, I visited and we attended an all-Black church. I was the only white kid, and all of my memories from being a part of that community are all positive. I don't have my church baggage comes from the white church. And I guess I had never really thought about it, but when she started talking about like community and church not being Sunday morning, but like the people that just were part of the community, I was like, oh yeah, those were just my dad's friends. Like that was just, you know, my little friend uncle type person that came to my birthday party. And I don't know. Anyway, it just is interesting to me as I just reflect on messages and different theologies that kind of became part of my bones and how it mixed together. I'm really grateful. And I think what she said at the end about just being open to learning, I think that we need to be really humble. I'm saying this as a white person. We need to be humble to learn and to grow and to see and to have my black and brown friends model and demonstrate church.
Mm. Yep.
So.
Yeah, I think it's especially important. You know, I'm drawing a connection. We had a class at our church recently on like the early church. And there's this contrast in the early church between like the church before Constantine that was persecuted and harassed. And there's this theology of martyrdom that develops and all this other stuff. And then there's the church post-Constantine. And it's not a super stark line, but there is this experiment of Christian imperialism, right, that begins where the church experiences some level of cultural power. So anyway, I'm just thinking about the difference in sort of theology and community development and what church feels like and is like, you know, in those two different modes. And it feels like there's an analogy there between the white church in the West that has traditionally had power and kind of how that developed for us. And then the black church, which has traditionally not had power. And so, you know, as Christy was saying, that it was survival for them. Like right. A lot of their theology and a lot of their community, you know, the way that church was for them was not like an aesthetic choice or or some sort of like academic theological choice. It was just, well, this is how we survive. Yeah. And I think especially in our current cultural moment, this is what I'm trying to bring this all around to. I think in our current cultural moment, the reason that I think for us as white people on this call, one of the reasons it's important, I think, to learn from the black church is that we are experiencing a loss of cultural power, right? Like the experience of Christianity and Christians being centered in this, like in the center of culture, is being sort of shaken and threatened, which is why we're seeing such a huge backlash, which is why we see, you know, Christian nationalism in the news as, you know, there's this effort to reassert that power. And I think there's the opportunity before us is to, instead of trying to reassert cultural power, is to turn to places like the black church and say, okay, what do we learn? How can we learn from you? You guys have been sort of under the thumb of, you know, you have not been in the good graces of cultural power for a long time. So how do we learn how to be the church from y'all, you know? So I think there's an opportunity for us to do that.
Yeah.
Things like that.
Yeah.
Instead of becoming raving Christian nationalists. Maybe we should do
that. I don't want to do that. I don't want to be a raving Christian nationalist.
or even just a non-raving one. I don't think any option is a
good
one for that.
No kind of Christian nationalist.
Yeah, let's not be any kind of, even just a quiet, polite one.
All right.
You don't have a joke, so you don't know how to end.
Christy?
Yes.
I thought you were my
friend.
I thought you were my friend.
I love that. I love that. I love that for you,
Christy,
Matt.
A duck walks into a bar and orders a pint of beer and a ham sandwich, and the barman looks at him and says, "Hang on, you're a duck." "I see your eyes are working," replies the duck. "And you can talk," exclaims the barman. "I see your ears are working too," says the duck. "Now, if you don't mind, can I have my beer and my sandwich, please?" "Certainly. Sorry about that," says the barman, and he pulls the duck's pint. "It's just we don't get many ducks in this pub. What are you doing around this way?" "I'm working on the building site across the road," explains the duck. "I'm a plasterer." The flabbergasted barman cannot believe the duck and wants to learn more, but takes the hint when the duck pulls out a newspaper from his bag and proceeds to read it. So the duck reads his paper, drinks his beer, eats his sandwich, bids the barman good day, and leaves. The same thing happens for 2 weeks. Then one day, the circus comes to town. And the ringmaster comes into the pub for a pint, and the barman says to him, "You're with the circus, aren't you? Well, I know this duck that could be just brilliant in your circus." He talks, drinks beer, eats sandwiches, reads the newspaper, everything. "Sounds marvelous," says the ringmaster, handing over his business card. "Get him to give me a call." So the next day, when the duck comes into the pub, the barman says, "Hey, Mr. Duck, I reckon I can line you up with a top job, paying really good money." "I'm always looking for the next job," says the duck. "Where is it?" "At the circus," says the barman. The circus, repeats the duck. That's right, replies the barman. The circus? The duck asks again. With the big tent? Yeah, the barman replies. With all the animals who live in cages and performers who live in caravans, says the duck. Of course, the barman replies. And the tent has canvas sides and a big canvas roof with a hole in the middle, persists the duck. Yes, that's right, says the barman. The duck shakes his head in amazement and says, what the hell would they want with a plasterer?
Pooch.
What? Hey. Hey, look. I was all set to just say goodbye, and then I got a little shade for not having a joke. So you got the duck joke today.
And you got the nickname. I think that might be the first time I've ever called you Pooch.
I know,
on
it's
the,
great.
On
just
the,
in exasperation.
On the podcast. We're going to need to edit that out. People are going to be like, wait, what? Listen, people, that again? Goes back to, like, you know, 20 years ago, yeah. A group of people just called you that.
Yes,
so.
That's yep. True.
Wow.
Well.
Well, friends, if you made it this far, if you made it to the end of our podcast, congratulations.
We're really sorry. No. Congratulations and so sorry.
Nothing to be sorry about.
So sorry, everybody.
Amazing. Mm. All right, everybody.
All right, friends. Happy Peace. Day.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Podcast. If you're finding it helpful, please tell your friends about it. Word of mouth is the best advertising. Ratings and reviews online also help others find the podcast, and don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. To join discussions about the podcast and lots more, join us in the Gravity community. It's free to join, and you can connect there with other listeners to the podcast to talk about faith and spirituality and whatever else comes up. To join, go to gravitycommons.com/community. The Gravity Podcast is produced by Ben Sternke and Matt Tebbe. Aaron Sternke edits and mixes the podcast. You can check out his mixing, engineering, and production work at aaronsternke.com. Finally, we would love to hear from you. To record a question or comment for us, you can go to gravitycommons.com/message and click the start recording button. You can also email us at podcast@gravitycommons.com. Catch you next time.
People are driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. The hiring process can be slow and overwhelming. Simplify hiring with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. Listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. That's Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Terms and conditions apply. People are driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. The hiring process can be slow and overwhelming. Simplify hiring with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. Listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. That's Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Terms and conditions apply.